tell me that the human race did not survive. There are no people in the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Yes, welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is our call-in show for Monday, April 12th, 2021. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards from across the country. You can tune in also to our Friday News Roundup show, where Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And you can get both by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. But you can only join the conversation live on the Podbean app or on our YouTube channel on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show right now on the Podbean app, you can show us some love right this moment. You can drop us a few bucks in our tip jar by clicking that little gift icon at the bottom of your screen. You can fill your digital pockets with Podbean's golden beans and send us a gift of your choice. Every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast. And we've been, I'm telling you, it's been keeping up with things lately has been bad. It's a good problem to have. You can also help boost the signal of this show by heading on over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already and smash that subscribe button and hit the like on the stream for this show, right? Like that stream and hit that notification bell so that you'll know every time that we go live. And if you're looking for more PA progressive talk, well, tune into the Rick Smith Show live. Their live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday, right after the show tonight. His YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook, any place you can stream, Rick is there. You can also subscribe to his daily podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just head on over to the ricksmithshow.com for all the latest across all his platforms. And you absolutely must check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night podcast. You can find it on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast. Episode 2, the one, the only Katie Booth. Senator Katie Booth is there. It is already recorded, and it's going to drop any moment right now. Make sure to subscribe now and join the fray with the amazing PA women who are stirring the political podcast cauldron and know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Make sure to follow them on Twitter at The Night Caucus, and make sure you subscribe to that podcast. And for all you gamers out there, check out The Game Inn for all your gaming needs. The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based, black family-owned gaming store, and they just happen to be like the parents of one of my son's best friends, so which is why I always give them the shout-out. They have friends of the show. They have almost every gaming product you want, for retro N64s right up to the most current material. So current console, sorry. They have video games for all platforms, large collection of collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, and kids get a discount with every A on the report card. You can check them out their Facebook page. Just look up The Game Inn. That's with two N's. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn, again with two N's. Got a question about a game, look for something hard to get, message them on Facebook, dropping them an email at thegameinnpa@gmail.com or give them a call at 267-424-2535. And a special shout out, as always, goes to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page or follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. Again, two N's. We got the two N thing going here. That's at SongADayMan, and that is Jonathan Mann. Please do check him out. Feels like the Guinness Book of World Records for the most songs written consecutively, consecutive days. I can't remember. It's a crazy number right at this point. Anyways, on today's show, I'm thrilled. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while now. Welcome Chad Dickelson. He's a community organizer with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, or CELDEF. Chad has been engaged in community rights work since 2009, initially working with Envision Spokane on Bill of Rights, protecting neighborhoods, workers, and the environment. He then moved on to assist in New England, working with communities in Maine and New Hampshire to protect their environment. He now lives and organizes in Pennsylvania, assisting communities to engage in rights-based organizing on issues ranging from environmental protection to prisoners' rights. Chad has been involved in the fight in Pennsylvania's townships to pass home rule powers to resist the decimation of their communities by the fracking industry. Most notably, Chad's work in Grant Township, PA, has been part of an ongoing fight to assert the rights of a community to protect its own environments and to extend legal rights to the natural environment. We're going to talk about those relationships, the relationship between those things. And the story of Grant Township is like a David and Goliath story, a battle that began more than 7 years ago and is scheduled to go before the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court this summer. That was part of lawsuit number three, I'm told. The Grant Township battle is only has only emboldened other PA towns. Just last month, residents of Clara Township in Potter County, PA, voted to support to consider home rule powers after Roulette Oil and Gas tried to get a permit for a fracking waste well there. Chad and Seldeth have been on the cutting edge of making a case for legal rights for the natural world. The fight in Grant Township, PA, featured heavily in the recent documentary by Melissa Troutman and Joshua Ribinick. It's called Invisible Hand, The Rights of Nature. And that's the one that the one and the only Mark Ruffalo was the executive producer for that film. And I have to say, if you really want to kind of like hear more of Chad after tonight, go check out that film because Chad is all over the place in there. It was good. So, Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, so I got to say, what did it feel like there to like be a bit of a movie star for that film? Was that something that you signed up for?
No, and I reject the title. No, it was not something that I was looking for, and I can't speak on behalf of the people at Grant Township, but I don't think that's what they were after either. But it turned into a really great documentary, and I think it gives a really good description of not only what's happening in the community regarding their resistance to oil and gas waste that's attempting to be dumped into their community, but also gives a really good description as well of what the larger forces are that are acting on our communities today, as well as what the future of environmental activism might look like. So, but no, I didn't want that.
No, of course. I mean, and what it was fascinating. I remember when Melissa Troutman was reporting upon some of the stuff in Grant Township years ago. And I had not put two and two together that this is actually the same fight and the same for what she had been covering up in that region too, as well. And to see the work that you're doing with Seldef kind of come together with the reporting she had done and then end up in this film was pretty spectacular. I do recommend people check it out because it's an extraordinarily well done film, and I think it covers the kind of things that we're going to be talking about tonight and some of the issues that are going on there, but also the broader issue about kind of legal rights for the natural environment, which is just absolutely fascinating. So we'll just kind of get in, reset the table here after my movie thing. So, Chad, tell us a little bit about Seldef and the kind of work that you do there. What does Seldef do? What's their kind of purpose, and how did Seldef get involved in Pennsylvania?
Seldef's been around for a long time, over 20 years at this point in Pennsylvania, 25 years about actually. And we originally started out. Sorry, I'm not sure if you can. Somebody revving their engine outside my window, Yeah, so we originally in Pennsylvania opened to provide pretty basic environmental protection techniques, which was communities would call us with a specific problem, whether it was around mining or factory farms, the spreading of sewage sludge. Later, it's become more about oil and gas issues. And, you know, we can get into it maybe later in the show if we have time. At this point, our organization doesn't just work on environmental issues. There's a lot of other issues that communities face as well that we think are relevant to a wider systemic problem where the core fundamental issue is that communities don't have the authority they need to protect themselves and to do what's in their best interest. So we started basically doing work that at this point we would find to be not worth our time, essentially, which was appealing permits that were issued to communities around specific issues. So like the things that I mentioned. And when a corporation gets a permit, it's usually issued by, in Pennsylvania, State Department of Environmental Protection. At the federal level, it could be the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, there's this wide variety of environmental protection agencies that issue these permits that allow a certain amount of harm to happen. So it could be how much pollution gets put into the waterway, how much pollution gets put into the air, how much gas gets to be dumped through a pipeline in a day, how much waste gets to be dumped into an injection well, these types of things. At some point, we thought that the environmental protection agencies were going to be there to stop these activities and to stop the harms that go along with these activities. And we found that the protection agencies are there to actually regulate the amount of harm that happens, not to stop it.
Right.
So I'm going to just speed through these things pretty quickly here, because I think that the work that's happening now is a little more important. But basically, we had an idea that our government and our governmental agencies were set up to actually protect communities and protect the environment. And what we found was that our working through that system didn't actually end up protecting communities or protecting the environment. It was really about regulating how much harm happened over time. And so we decided at some point to stop doing that work and say, this isn't what we got into it for. We don't want to watch the slow demise of communities. We don't want to watch the slow death. We don't want to watch the slow poisoning of communities. We would like to figure out a better solution that actually gives communities the tools they need, independent of us. It's not just about the cell death here, you know, doing the work, that actually changes the structure so that communities have the authority and ability they need to stop harms, and also not just to stop bad things, but also to put into place positive, proactive visions for what a more sustainable community would look like for people for the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years into the future. So I feel like most activism is often about stopping harms and just trying to do the best we can with the system. And, you know, we're constantly on defense, trying to stop whatever we can at any point. And we often don't take the time to think as well about what kind of a system do we need that's going to allow us to actually put into place what it is that's going to be sustainable and protective into the future. So that's where we pivoted.
So let me ask you this. So there's in several of the articles that I've read about, say, what's happening in, say, in Grant Township and some of the other communities that you've been involved with, too, as well. That involves, I mean, if I'm hearing you right, that also involves helping community members understand what their legal rights are and what's possible within, say, the constraints of the giving system. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. And so when communities contact us, you know, it's usually about a single specific issue that the community is worried about. But then a lot of our work, which is what I do and most of my colleagues do, is we go in and we help communities understand how the system works. Why is it that we can't say no? Why is it that we seem to be constantly getting harmed? And why is it that the system seems to be set up to actually take power away from us at every turn? So it's a lot of education. It's not just a legal strategy. And we're also not there to try to tell communities what they should or should not do. And we usually, you know, after several conversations with communities, there's often a decision point that we think communities need to arrive at, which is they can do nothing. Communities can also just try to work within the system and try to limit or regulate the harm. Or a third option is to try to step outside the box that's been created for us and do something different, because if we work within the system we've been given, we pretty much know where we'll end up at this point. And so how do we help people understand and educate and organize and agitate around what it looks like to understand where we're at? And then also what kinds of things, yeah, do we have to put in place to move forward with a different system?
Right. And one of the things that struck me more than anything else, before we get to the specifics of what's going on, it has been going on in Grand Township. One of the things that seemed to me is I saw some of the shift, and I mentioned this to you before we started the show, that the more I read about the kind of, you know, the rights for the natural environment, and more I read about the kind of, say, philosophy and the strategy behind this, the more I do see this as this is kind of like paradigmatic change kind of thinking. Right, that we're no longer going to only fight, you know, the fight that's right, you know, at the tip of our nose, but we're thinking about kind of transforming the how that we relate, say, to the natural world. And I can't see that, you know, this happening at a better time right now when we absolutely need these kind of tools when we're facing a climate crisis.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I don't have a lot to add to what you just mentioned other than to say, as well, that this is work that's been happening over, you know, I mean, we're building on movements over the past several generations, and this is not short-term work. And so each Grant Township's battle, for example, is incredibly important. And also it's a flashpoint in the part of a larger movement about who makes the decisions where we live and at what level are we going to organize and where do we think we have the most leverage and the most power. So education is a giant component of that. You know, I work for a law firm. I'm not a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And we have several lawyers that work with us who have dedicated their life to this work. And so, you know, we think the legal component is a definitely an important aspect of this. At the same point, or at the same time, there is a lot of other organizing education that accompanies any legal strategy. And we have to understand that the educational, the understanding, the and the future vision all work in tandem with both what's happening in the legal system as well as what's happening on the ground. And these are not short-term battles.
So let's talk then about Grant Township. I mean, let's talk about what's happening here in Pennsylvania. Let's talk about kind of where you entered that space. Right. What was the fight about in Grant Township and what's the fight about now? I mean, because now you mentioned this to me before we went on air today. This is like the third round of lawsuits. But my understanding is that the organizing has happened continuously during that period of time.
Yeah, I'll try to stop me if I get too long here, because this is, you know, a 7-year battle at this point. But originally in Grant Township, there was a frack waste injection well that was proposed. And
this is basically they take all the frack water waste, they kind of pump it over here and they inject it deep underneath the earth, right? And this is kind of what we're talking about, an injection well.
Correct. So frack waste contains radioactive components. It contains a bunch of stuff that we don't even know about. The things that we do know about, which include things like toluene and benzene, they're cancer-causing agents. So that stuff gets dumped into the community's old well sites, and it can get put into the water supply. It's caused earthquakes in other states. It's caused spills. We know it's contaminated drinking water. So, and there's a lot of things that we don't know about them as well.
But so basically this is what we've seen, right? This is what we've seen in Oklahoma, right? We've seen kind of geologists who basically tracked what's happened in Oklahoma and basically didn't be able to attribute it to the, you know, and to exactly this process. We saw this in Ohio with cases in Ohio where the kind of the slick water waste is kind of pumped into there and reactivating plates that had been kind of long dormant and causing slippages there. This is kind of what we're talking about, right?
Correct. Right. Yes, it's basically a giant toilet for the oil and gas industry.
Yep.
And so that's what they're facing. And it's a small community. Grant Township is about 700 people. It's rural. It's poor. The annual tax base for the community is about $32,000 that comes in for this community. So, you know, just put that in perspective, maybe with where other folks who are listening to this live. It's really rural, it's really poor, and it was definitely targeted as a place to put this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So for those reasons,
we got
right?
a call from them.
For exactly those reasons.
Yes, I believe so. Yep. And so we got a call because they had been appealing this permit that had been issued. First, there's two permits that were required for injection wells in Pennsylvania. One comes from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. The second comes from the State Department of Environmental Protection. Not to get too nerdy and all this stuff, but mm-hmm. basically, we also came across a note that had been written in one of the initial conversations with the township, which basically said, the township has no say in this. This is not the township's discretion. This is a state and a federal matter. It's not a local matter. And so if the state and the federal agencies permit this, you're going to get it. And that's what has to happen. And so that was kind of when they started talking to us and they said, hey, how can we fight this? How can we, you know, appeal this permit? And we had been doing this work at this point long enough to say, we don't think you're going to win the permit appeals, because the permit appeals to the EPA and to the DEP. And just to say, you know, especially even at the federal level, a lot of folks want to come at us and say, well, how are things different under a Biden administration versus a Trump administration versus right. the Obama administration? Sure. A lot of the communities that we talked to were no better off under Obama or Biden at this point than they were under a Trump administration. Right. These are federal agencies or state agencies that administer state or federal law, which are there to allow these harmful activities to take place. They're not there to protect the environment, despite what their name says. The protection agencies, either the state or the federal level. So those are hard conversations to have with communities, because there is the sense that there is still some sort of protection mechanism that's going to be there to stop the worst things to come in. And so it's laid out in the film that Melissa and Josh did. You know, I had a difficult conversation with a community group early on, and this is right. very common for me with other groups that I talk about, where they don't want to hear that there's not some easy answer to just say no to these things, or even to just, you know, make sure that they're not going to get harmed. So that was the conversation we went through with the community. They lost the permit appeal at the federal level. The EPA basically said, well, you know, we've done the tests, we've done whatever we need to do, we're going to allow this thing to go forward. And so that permit was issued. That permit is still technically in effect today that authorizes at the federal level frack waste to be injected into Grant Township today. It's still there. At that point, they basically said, well, we either have to allow it or we're going to have to try something new. And that was where we discussed with them passing these local laws that basically says, listen, we don't want to just talk about frack waste. We want to talk about the fundamental rights of the people that live here, and also the fundamental rights of the ecosystems that exist within this community that should not have to be harmed. And we don't want to just take into account what a federal environmental agency says. This is really a question of who makes the decisions in this community. Is it those of us that live here? Is it the ecosystems that live here? Or is it, you know, some bureaucrats that live hundreds of miles away that are making decisions for us? So they shifted the conversation away from just fracking waste into rights. Who has rights here? The community, the ecosystem, things like that. So they passed a law, and I'm going to try to speed this up just for the sake of the listeners as well as the conversation. But, you know, slow me down if you want. But to say that they passed a law in June of 2014, you know, a long time ago, that said, we're going to ban frack waste because this violates the ecosystem's rights in the community. It violates the people's right to self-government. And we should be the ones that get to make decisions on this. And we're not going to relinquish our authority to make decisions in the best interest of what we know is right for our community, our water, and the natural systems and ecosystems that exist here.
Okay, so this is really like the pivotal moment, right? The pivotal shift, right, yes. right here. This is like the I speak for the trees moment, right? And so here's what I'm really curious about. I want to just make sure that everybody gets this, right? So on the one hand, you're talking about a like asserting of self-governance, right, by the community over its own, say, like territory, right? How it's defining its community, its municipality, and so on. And basically saying, we make the decisions over the space that we live, right? And then at the same time, and this is the part that I found absolutely fascinating that I want to ask you about. So that you're saying we're going to grant rights to the natural environment. Now, I've got to imagine, and maybe you tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I've got to imagine that when you start talking to people, right, who've never heard about rights for the natural environment before, they're got to look at you like you're a nut job, right? They're like, oh, what? You're basically going to say that, you know, you want us to go all hug the trees and they're going to live next door to us and we have, you know, the right to marry trees now. And I mean, I could see those conversations coming out because of what I think are common sense way of imagining the environment, common sense, remember, of rights, that would just be an absurd assertion. So how do you get to that point where you're basically saying you've got this group of kind of rural Pennsylvanians, like in this community, basically saying, nope, we're going to pass this charter granting the environment rights?
Yeah. And I don't know where to start with that, because it also may be worth going into the history of it, which is what was the first community, at least the settler colonial community, that passed rights of nature. And that was in Tamaqua Borough, not far from, I think, where you're at.
Yes.
In, you know, rural eastern Pennsylvania.
Correct.
Which is, you know, basically former coal country. And that was in 2006. So we can get into the history a bit more if you want. But just to talk practically about what rights of nature means and how these conversations go within communities, it's a somewhat easy conversation in some ways, because there's an understanding that, and I think this is, there's a legal shift and there's a cultural shift that's happening with rights of nature conversations. On the legal side, there's two things going on. Number one, under traditional conventional environmental law, to just take, for example, the Clean Water Act, mm-hmm. which was passed in the 1970s, And under the Clean Water Act right now, if you wanted to try to invoke the Clean Water Act to protect the water in your community, you have to show that you have some sort of property or commercial interest in order to try to protect the water. So that you're a property owner and the water was polluted upstream, and therefore that takes property value away from your house. And so you've been harmed because of that. Or if you're a fisherman or something like that, and the fish have died because of some sort of pollution that happened upstream and you can no longer make a living, then you have a commercial, a property harm, something like that. So you have to prove basically that you have been harmed economically or some sort of property aspect in order to try to invoke these other environmental laws. You know, we're talking about watershed environmental laws that most Americans, you know, talk about in terms of the Environmental Rights Amendment from the 70s. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, National Endangered Species Act, National Environmental Policy Act, all these things. Those are mostly based on property and commerce.
Yep.
What, from a legal perspective, a rights of nature law does is it says you don't just have to have a property or a commercial damage in order to try to protect the environment where you live. Just by virtue of being a member of the community, you have the authority, in some cases the duty, to protect the environment, not just for human benefit, but also for the benefit of the ecosystems there. So it's about taking it away from property and commerce and recognizing that everybody that lives in the community has an authority and potentially a duty to protect the environment. The other thing legally that's a big difference in that is it's recognizing that if you get a win, that the damages that you would gain don't go back just into the person that brought the lawsuit. They go back into restoration of the ecosystem itself. So right now, you know, if you're a person that's been aggrieved under the Clean Water Act, like your property values have gone down, you bring a lawsuit under the Clean Water Act and you win, basically you personally get that money. Under a rights of nature law, it's about going back into making the ecosystem whole, making the ecosystem healthy again. So those are, I mean, those are potentially, you know, just kind of legalistic terms, but they're big deals because it's allowing anybody in the community to bring an interest and an action on behalf of the ecosystem. And making sure it's not just individuals that are benefiting from it, it's the actual ecosystem that's going to be benefiting. So it's almost a guardian relationship that we're talking about. On the cultural side, it's really about helping people understand as well that the ecosystem and the environment is not just there for benefit of humans, that we're actually a part of the ecosystem, we're a part of the larger community. And so it's about recognizing that we're there within the natural environment and we're there to be essentially an association and a relationship with it, not see it as something separate from us. And that's kind of, I think, a lot of the harder work. So, but in general, I mean, most folks, communities, you know, that we've worked with, there's not a lot of opposition. It's, you know, some people are like, well, can I still mow my lawn or can I, remove a bird's nest from my gutter? You know, there's a lot of things like that. But these are not hard questions to overcome. It's talking about them on a systemic level, on a bigger picture level.
Well, and it's interesting. I was explaining to my wife earlier on today, right? I was just basically, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, having you on, some of the background and things that I've been reading, and we're just kind of talking about it. And she's like, oh, so it's basically just basically doing what they did for corporations, right? to like for the natural environment, except the end game is a fundamentally different one. I'm like, yep, there you go. right. And what kind of clicked for me when I was first reading about this too, is like, you know, if you think about the rights that we've granted to corporations, we've given them personhood rights. We've given them certain kind of rights. You know, again, they can't speak for themselves. Right. So they're a lot less alive and a lot less a part of it, that much more of a construction than is the natural environment. But it's essentially saying, and I saw this over and over again in the literature, about until you give something rights, right, you cannot recognize it as anything other than an object under law. And what I thought that was fascinating with thinking about the parallel with corporations, because if the corporation, if you're giving them rights in order to have personhood and protections under our legal system, under our constitution, you're doing that in order to achieve an end for those corporations, right? Which is the profit, further extraction, and a doubling down on the wholesale destruction of our natural environment, in my view, right? But what you're talking about here, which you just began touching upon, is that, you know, this, the you know, reparations for this, or what you would get after a lawsuit, or what you get protection, it would go back into restoration of the natural environment, into that which is common. And in there, you start to see the intersections with these kind of indigenous knowledges, right? These indigenous kind of traditions, about ways to talk about things that we began seeing in all sorts of struggles by First Nations, to kind of stop pipelines, to make sure that their rights are protected, and asserting that the land has these rights. And to see this Western Western tradition meeting these indigenous traditions, I think is absolutely fascinating in a way that, you know, and I've, again, was just talking with some people about this. There doesn't seem to be the same kind of resistance that, you know, maybe we would even see, we saw like 20 years ago to this understanding of the world.
Yeah, no, I think I would agree. And I think there's, I mean, we can get back to Grant Township.
Yes.
And I mean, we're getting a little theoretical here, but I mean, another, I think, shining example of how this works is a community like Toledo, Ohio, which a couple of years ago passed a law that gave Lake Erie rights to exist and flourish. And Toledo, you know, not necessarily known as a progressive,
right,
liberal hotbed of environmental activism. And people in the community overwhelmingly by popular vote voted in rights for Lake Erie. The next morning, you know, about less than 12 hours later, there was a lawsuit that came in from the agribusiness industry that was worried about what's this going to mean for our factory farms. And, you know, the it's gone through the courts. I don't want to get too much into it, but
sure,
also to say that what happened in Lake Erie, which was, you know, a Rust Belt community, traditionally non-environmentally activist that we would think of, passed it in overwhelmingly, and that community has now gotten international media and attention that's being used to inspire other efforts, not just, you know, in Ohio or in the Midwest, but in other countries around the world. So we've come up with kind of a timeline recently, you know, in terms of the rights of nature work that looks at where it started, at least in settler colonial communities in 2006 in Tamaqua Borough. And how it's expanded, and it's gone in fits and starts, and there's going to be legal wins and losses. But we also like to put it in context of what other movements in this country and other movements around the world have looked like, which is you're going to lose in the courts for a while.
Right.
But at the same time, those losses also illuminate how the system works. They help folks understand where they sit within the system. And, you know, it's going to be starts and stops, but that there has been a giant cultural shift, and the rights of nature work, both at the legal level as well as at the cultural level, has been taking off, due in, you know, large part to these small communities who a lot of people don't usually think of being where they would look for radical environmental activism. And that means Tamaqua, that means Grant Township, that means Toledo. It's not, you know, and I like Portland, Oregon, it's fine. But it's not the Portlands.
Right.
It's not the Boulder, Colorados. It's not the Ashevilles where this stuff is beginning. And I think that's an important lesson in terms of looking at how movements build, is it's where people are affected. And it's also where people are really willing to look outside the box and take into account what is it that, what are the driving questions here? What is at root? What is wrong? And how do we look at new things to put in its place? That's really, I think, where it's coming from.
Absolutely.
Motivation.
Absolutely. I mean, well put. I mean, right on the money. I mean, I think that is so much of the takeaway that I think people need to hear. And especially, you know, these false understandings, I think, in many ways of social movements, say there's these conservative areas, there's these liberal areas. I think that just kind of doesn't allow us to actually see where the problems are, where the solutions can be generated, where the organizing should be happening. But that's something that has been a recurring theme in our podcast over the years. So let's get back to Grant Township. So Grant Township, they passed this ordinance. There's been several layers of kind of lawsuits that, again, they pass this and they get sued, right? Not only by the industry, but by the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, correct. And I'll try to keep this brief because the legal ins and outs are pretty wild. But they've been sued twice now in federal court by the industry that wants to dump the waste. The first lawsuit was in 2014, and the last one was in 2020, at the end of last year. But then in Grant Township understood that they were likely to continue to get taken to the cleaners in the court. They didn't believe that the court was ever really going to protect them. So in 2017, it was in 2015, they adopted what's called a Home Rule Charter, which is basically like a local constitution. There is a process for all communities in Pennsylvania to go through. It's basically a year to 2 year process where, and this may sound boring to folks at first, but it's really kind of interesting. Usually in most communities in Pennsylvania, we operate under what's called the codes for our community. If you live in a township, you have a township code. If you live in a borough, you have the borough code. If you live in a city, you have a city code. And these were written by people, you know, decades ago. And they basically lay out a one-size-fits-all governing structure for the place that we live, no matter whether you're a township of 300 people or whether you're a township of 50,000 people. And that's not to, those are literal numbers. Like, there's townships in Pennsylvania that are 50,000 people, and there's townships that are 300.
Right.
And yet you have a code that outlines this structure of law for how all these communities are going to be governed. Under a charter structure of government, you actually get to put into place the charter in the form of government that you want. You get to say, hey, these are the things we like. These are the things we don't like. We're going to have public hearings. We're going to involve the community in this. And then we're going to put it up for a vote. And the community gets to decide whether they want to put in this new structure of government or not. The folks of Grant Township did that. And so they have this new constitution, this new structure of government. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection at that point then got involved and said, hey, this basically interferes with our ability to enforce oil and gas policy within your community.
This is incredible.
So the DEP sued them. We hadn't seen that before. We've seen communities be threatened by the Attorney General in the past for a variety of other issues that we can get into later if there's time. But yeah, the Department of Environmental Protection essentially stepped in front of the industry and said, you don't have the authority to regulate oil and gas activity like injection wells in your community. That's our job at the state level. So we are going to sue you for protecting your environment. So that lawsuit's still ongoing. In response to that, Grant Township countersued the DEP.
Nice.
And we're working with them and the legal stuff with that. And they said, basically, look, we've had no choice because you're not doing your job. You're not protecting the environment. And so you're also selling out communities under Article 1, Section 27 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, which is the Environmental Rights Amendment that basically said all communities and all people in the communities have a right to clean air and to pure water. And so if you're not going to do your job, we have no choice except to take this action at the local level. So we're suing you for basically violating your duty and your oath under the Constitution. So now there's this big thing that's going on. We're going to trial. It looks like at this point it's probably going to be October. And there's going to be a big argument about whether the DEP can sue communities at the local level that are trying to protect their environment. And then we're also going to be putting the DEP on trial for basically saying, look, you violated your duty under the Constitution to protect communities. And communities need the right and they need the authority to do this, these types of actions, because otherwise they're going to continue to be sacrificed, not just by the industry, but also now by our own state government. And that's, I think, where the things meet for us. We call it a corporate state, where not only do we have corporations threatening communities and polluting communities, we have our own state governments, our elected officials that are now coming in on behalf of corporations to try to punch the communities down. So that's where I think, you know, it's not just about injection wells, it's not even just environmental issues. That's why we're working on a lot of other issues these days as well, is corporations, the industries, the state are really working in concert to try to keep communities from being able to actually make decisions on what's important to them. And that's what's at the core of our work.
So how much did that environmental protections as written in the Pennsylvania Constitution, how much did that play a role in these cases actually getting to where they are at that and the success of some of the organizing? I mean, have you seen similar, kind of successes and mobilizations in other states? Does Pennsylvania stand out in particular because of that clause in its constitution where it brings it to a constitutional fight?
Yeah, I think that's hard to say. I do think it has played a role in Grant Township, but also we're working also with communities at a different level, which is not just about the Environmental Rights Amendment, which is, you know, Article 1, Section 27, which I mentioned, but also it was introduced in the last session, and it looks like it'll probably be introduced again in this session of the legislature, but about a fundamental right to self-government. That communities, independent of even just environmental concerns, have a right to make decisions about issues that affect health and safety where they live. So we're, you know, the Environmental Rights Amendment is an important component of the Grant Township fight, but we also think that's not just the end all, that there also needs to be a broader constitutional amendment that recognizes that communities do need more authority than they currently have to make important decisions. So I don't know that it's different in terms of the Pennsylvania amendment. I think if we're going to talk constitutional stuff, I think it's an important component here. But we also think it doesn't go far enough and that we are going to need continuing constitutional protections that we're going to be working on for the next few years.
Very good, very good. Let me just kind of give a program update. So everybody, I want to let you know that if you do have, say, questions, I see some questions starting to come in on YouTube that I'm going to I'll pass off the chat in just a moment. But I also want to remind you that you can help support this show, become a patron of Raging Chicken with a little $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Or if you're listening on Podbean, you can show us some love right now during the show by clicking that little gift icon at the bottom. Every gift that you send helps support and expand this podcast. And if you are listening on YouTube, make sure you hit that, smash that subscribe button and kind of like this stream, and please share it with your friends so that we can signal boost this podcast and make sure that this voice gets out beyond the folks that are right here today. So we have one question here that came in from Cyril that said, so there's been some backlash to your work by anti-environmental right-wing Republicans like in Florida, where they have legislated a preemptive ban on local rights to nature efforts. One of the things I was going to ask you about there tonight too as well. Are we seeing that kind of any other states like in Pennsylvania or some other places? Do you have anything to add to that one?
Yeah, definitely. It's happened in Florida. It's happened in Ohio. We've seen that happen in some Midwest states. It's pretty common. And in some ways, yeah, I don't want to cheer it or celebrate it, but I think it means that the work is beginning to become enough of a threat to those in power that that's what's going to happen. We expect those types of backlashes. In Ohio, for example, after the Lake Erie Bill of Rights was passed, the Ohio legislature passed a law that said that the Ohio state government was authorized essentially to strike down local laws that recognized rights of nature. And so the Lake Erie Bill of Rights was sued not only just by the industry, but then the Ohio Attorney General came in and tried to strike it down as well. So these are, yeah, it's normal. It's, I think, a part of how movements build. But yeah, we're not cheering these things, but we recognize that when the states start passing laws that ban local communities right. from enacting things that protect nature or protect people and communities and things like that, it's a natural part of the evolution here.
Right. I mean, this is kind of like, not to be cliche about it, but like as the saying goes, right? First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. That's kind of that idea, is that once you start getting recognition where they're actually putting resources and time and feeling like they have to fight back, means that there's been some inroads made into the popular discourse and building power. And so they're actually feeling the pressure, which I think is, which is phenomenal to hear.
Yeah. And it's not just rights of nature, to just step back for a second well. I mean, state preemption and federal preemption has been a thing for, you know, decades and decades. In Pennsylvania, we did a study several years ago where we looked at all the times that the Pennsylvania legislature has used preemption law, basically where the state steps in and takes power away from communities to make decisions. And that's on almost any issue you can think of. You know,
gun laws. It's all over the place in gun laws, right? I mean, this happens all over the state in Pennsylvania.
It's guns, it's plastics, it's energy policy, it's food policy, it's water policy, it's GMOs. It's almost anything you can think. Basically, to get out of bed in the morning, you're not allowed to make decisions on things that allow you to actually get up in the morning. Somebody else in Harrisburg or DC or a different state capital is making those decisions. I mean, that's really what it is. And so it's preemption. It's the state. It's a higher level of government, which is usually influenced by corporate interests that are making the decisions, and they try to pull authority away from our communities. And so the rights of nature stuff is an extension of that. And we expect to see more and more of that.
Great, great. So this case in, I want to come back to one issue about this preemption thing in a minute. But I want to kind of put a little button up some of the stuff on Grant Township a little bit, and on how that basically now we're starting to see this this case moving forward in Clara Township, which sounds to me. Let me ask you this first: the one in Clara Township that's just starting, this seems to be following a similar pattern that what we saw in Grant Township. Am I right?
Yeah, it seems to be. It's a different community, so we never know how things are going to go. But, you know, it's a small community. It's rural as well, facing an injection well. And they have initiated a home rule campaign. And their first vote, so home rule campaigns are two election cycles, but the first one is May 18th. Mm-hmm. And so, there's discussions going on with them, not just from, you know, our organization, but with other communities we've worked with to help them understand what they're up against. What the campaign might look like, but So that's going to happen. The first vote will be May 18th, and we'll see what happens with that.
And so I assume that they're looking at what's happening in Grant Township as a certain kind of model or kind of like example to really put in kind of concrete terms what this might look like.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I can't speak to the motivations of people. I think though.
Sure.
It's because, I mean, when you look at Grant Township, I don't know. It's been going on for so long in three court fights and still going on that, you know, they might understand like what the trajectory might look like. But I think in conversations with some folks I've had up there, what I'm hearing is that they don't know how it's going to go, but they really understand that this is a question of what the future of their community looks like and home rule in this next campaign. And I don't want to get too cliche about it. I feel like I keep hammering on that, but I don't know how else to say it. Mm-hmm. Is when folks understand that somebody else, somewhere else, or some other industry continues to try to take authority away from the people that are being most affected, that's starting to, it feels like it sticks more. And also, I would also say that, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, it used to be that people didn't believe that the DEP or the EPA were not going to protect them.
Right.
And it does feel like there's a different vibe with the communities I talk to these days, that folks understand that no matter who maybe is in charge at the presidential level or things like that,
you're going to get
that
screwed.
Those agencies are not. Yeah, exactly. And so if we don't organize differently and if we don't, you know, create some solidarity in a new type of movement, it's over. So
let's just to kind of the last part of button up on the Grant Township. So what's at stake in the court case that is, you say, in October is what we're going to see. And this goes before the Commonwealth Court. Am I correct?
Correct.
And that is the constitutional question of what takes precedence here. Right. The government's right to kind of exercise its authority through its institutions or the constitutional environmental amendment. Is that clashing?
Yeah, so there will be a few questions going on, and some of that's going to get narrowed down. But one is going to be whether the Grant Township Home Rule Charter, which bans injection wells, interferes with the DEP's ability to carry out oil and gas policy at the state level. So does the local interfere with the state? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another question is going to be, has the DEP essentially violated its duty under Article 1, Section 27, the Environmental Rights Amendment of the Constitution, to protect the community? Is it acting in ways that are not protecting communities? And is it acting in ways, and also, is there state law that's actually violating Article 1, Section 27 as well? Mm-hmm. Is things like the Oil and Gas Act and the way it's preempting communities from making decisions on oil and gas decisions, are those violating the community's ability to protect its health and safety and to protect its environment? So there's going to be several questions on trial there.
Well, we're definitely going to keep on following this all through, like, right through October and far beyond this. I mean, because now this is on my radar, it's just, I can't help. Like I said, I'm going down this rabbit hole because I just find this stuff absolutely fascinating. Let me ask you kind of more of I don't know if that, I don't want to kind of say philosophical question here because it's not right, kind of actually philosophical. It has to do with, I think, say, political trajectories and so on. And this the home rule move, the rights of nature stuff seems to me to be so incredibly disruptive to our traditional or common sense of the ways that we think about political categories, which I love this kind of, like, I love that because it forces us to actually think and actually focus on kind of what matters. But in this case, right, I get the sense that there are some people that start to get nervous with this kind of home rule charter stuff. What they hear echoes of is these kind of like far right kind of like libertarians that are all about get the government out of everything we do and then we're going to just do it for ourselves, which then leaves open that question about like, well, what we need, like, bigger groups of people to do things, right? Our small little town in Grant Township can't afford to build all its roads or build it out with an infrastructure or extend broadband internet or something like this, right? And then on the other hand, you know, so, and then you got those folks that are saying, like, yes, but shouldn't we be even focusing on changing what's happening at the at the governmental level, that what we need is more stronger kind of enforcement or more rigid rules and ones that kind of protect everyone, which then puts those local local communities back into like kind of like a caretaker relationship with here. I don't know if I'm articulating this well, but I feel like there's these, you know, people start to get nervous around the edges of this question about, you know, is this a direction that we should be going to granting everybody home rule? And I'm overstating the case here, but I don't know if you get what I'm getting at here.
I think so. And yeah, stop me if I'm not. Okay. I think there's a couple threads, but yeah, one of the major, you know, talking points that comes down, particularly when speaking with state legislators, is, well, how can we do this? Aren't we going to just have a patchwork of different local laws that each community gets to do X, Y, Z? And I mean, the short answer to that is we already do. Communities have zoning. They have their own laws and their own, you know, ideas of what they want for their communities. There's elements of local control that are given to communities. But right now, the authority for local control comes with strings attached. And it's got to be within line of the state or the federal priorities. So, you know, you're like, you can have some local control, but it basically means you get to move around where the injection well is going to go. Mm-hmm. Or you get to move around where these state policies are going to go that we want you to have. But you don't get to say no to them, yes or no. So there's that. Like, we already have local control, but it's only within state confines. The other thing I think that, if I'm hearing what you're getting at, is what is the limit on local control?
Right.
What happens if communities start passing laws that would ban, for example, African Americans or gay people or things like that? Or they would, you know, use the local authority to oppress or discriminate against certain classes of people. The laws that we work with, number one, they already do that. They don't need any authority from, you know, CELDEF or anybody else I work with to do that. That's already happening.
Right.
But the limitations that we work, that we put on that, both in terms of the laws that we draft with communities, as well as the state legislation that we're putting forward, is that the limitation on local control is that you can't use local control to violate rights that have already been secured and protected by higher levels of government. So under the state constitution or the federal constitution, that local communities can't use their local authority to violate or infringe on those rights that are already protected. So we think about it, if you think about it in terms of a pyramid, right now, basically at the state or the federal level, there's all these policies that are coming down on communities, and it gets lower and lower down to this little point where communities basically just get, you know, to play house with certain policies and things like that. Our vision of government, you know, just to turn it upside down, would be that communities get to have a lot of authority at the local level on all of these issues. But at the top of that pyramid, at the point, it's basically about protecting fundamental rights, rights for people to, you know, be free, to have all of their rights protected. And that's the purpose of government. And if we have governments, they're there to secure and protect the rights of the people and communities that they're there to serve and protect. And so you can't violate the things that are already protected by higher levels, but you can go above and beyond. So right now, just to take a very concrete example, if you have the DEP, you know, I'm not saying abolish the DEP in a different form, I might, but the DEP, you know, has very, very specific protections it sets up around water pollution, air pollution, things like that, and they issue permits and things like that. Those are fine. Those should be the minimum standards that communities have to abide by if they're going to allow oil and gas activity. Those are the minimums. But that community should be allowed to go above and beyond those protections and enact stricter ones. And so preemption right now says it sets a ceiling. Communities can't go beyond what the DEP says. We think that the DEP should set a floor. It's a very minimum protection, but communities should go above and beyond it to enact stricter protections if they want. And if they do those, like Grant Township, they shouldn't have to get frickin' sued over them and drawn into three different court battles. They have the authority to enact stricter protections. So it's really about flipping on its head what preemption is there for and who it serves. Right now it serves industry. You can't go above it. We're saying, fine, let's set a minimum floor that the DEP gets to enforce, but communities should have the authority to protect themselves more and go above and beyond that. So.
And like in so many ways, right, instead of it being the race to the bottom, right, you see the kind of like trajectory of now we're kind of moving forward, right, extending rights, expanding democracy, as opposed to limiting it and seeing what it was like, you know, what we can all live with. I love that idea about setting the floor as opposed to the ceiling. That's absolutely fantastic. Well, if anybody wants to, you've got any calls, you got any questions, any comments that you want to throw in, we're running up on time here, but I just want to give everybody one more opportunity. If you want to call in, you've got a question, you got a thought, you got a comment. or if you want to kind of put a question in the YouTube comments, that'd be fantastic here too as well. So let me ask you one more, well, two more things to kind of close out. One, you already mentioned that you're working on some statewide legislation. So what are you looking at in terms of statewide legislation, and what have those discussions been like with legislatures at this point? Are you finding some people being receptive to this? And what are the stages of that kind of legislative push?
Yeah, so the state legislation is the first amendment that was introduced as a constitutional amendment. It was introduced in the last session. The prime sponsor was Representative Danielle Friel Otten, and she put it forward. There was several co-sponsors, but it is about the right to local self-government. It's saying that communities should have the authority to pass laws that protect their health and safety, and that are free from state preemption and also corporate interference, if those laws are about protecting health and safety. And also that the limitation on those laws is basically what we were just talking about. The limitation on those laws is that they can't be in violation of existing state or federal laws that protect rights. So that's the thing. It's basically about trying to decentralize the current governmental structure, give communities more power and authority, make sure that the power and authority that communities have can't be used to oppress or discriminate, but it needs to be falling in line with, you know, state and federal laws regarding protecting rights. So there's generally, you know, it's been interesting. We've gotten, it's a relatively new effort at the state level. It's not just happening in Pennsylvania. There's also discussions happening in Ohio, Oregon, New Hampshire. It's been introduced. And I wouldn't say it falls into traditional categories as well as, you know, similar to our local work. There's some Democrats that we found that we thought would be supportive of it that haven't been. There's been some, you know, Republicans or Libertarians that we thought, you know, would be less supportive, but have been more interested in it. You know, so there's this kind of local control argument, but it's nonpartisan. And that's what our work is often about as well, which often surprises people, that a lot of the rights of nature work, it's happening in places that, you know, aren't traditionally liberal or things like that. And I think this work, you know, I don't want to get too cliche here, but it falls across a lot of different lines. And it's really not about who, is it the Republicans or is it the Democrats? It's really talking about fundamental issues that are facing our communities. And so it's going to be an uphill slog. We don't expect it to, I think, you know, necessarily pass in the next session or even two sessions. But I'll say that once it gets introduced, it offers us a lot of other conversations, particularly with local elected officials. I can't tell you how many local elected officials I talk to that when I ask them, hey, when's the time that you've run into state preemption or that you've run into, you know, an industry that's been, you've been concerned about and you've been told by your solicitor, you know, your township super or your township lawyer that you can't say no. People are usually like, yeah, they always have one. Everybody knows about it. And so that's really what this is about, which is, you know, the elected officials saying at the local level, my hands are tied. I feel like I'm handcuffed. How can I make a difference here? I don't have the tools or authority I need. And so then they end up compromising. So we're really using the state level work right now to help raise awareness about just how deep and how far preemption goes. And then work along those lines to build a grassroots level. Because, I'll just be honest with you. I don't know that anything in Harrisburg is going to change anytime soon.
Sure.
We do think it's important to introduce state level work there, but in order to actually get a change forced through there, it's going to take a really big grassroots movement, particularly in Pennsylvania. And I think that's also true in other states. And so how do we use the stuff that's happening at the state level to build a larger grassroots coalition? And that's really, I think, the work that...
No, absolutely. And I think that even when you said, you know, this, the legislation was originally brought in by Danielle Otten, the fact is that she's like heading the kind of climate group right now, right? In the Pennsylvania Democratic Caucus, who's absolutely fantastic. The fact that you see a lot of these issues kind of, you know, have been paying attention to. I see a lot of organizing that's happening at the local level that, again, at least in my lifetime, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, right? I have not seen the organizing, the interest at a local level in the way that that is happening right now. And I think it's all built for these kind of movements. And I think, you know, exactly what you said, yes, it's not going to change anytime soon, but it's about getting the pieces together, right? You know, again, you know, I hate to kind of go back to, you know, the anti environmental justice dude like Milton Friedman, right? You know, when he's talking about, you know, when, you know, in a, only times in crisis, it's the ideas that are lying around, right? This is something that I think, say, progressives, the people that are, might be listening to this show, have not really paid that much attention to. It's like really actually building out that infrastructure and organizing for the long haul, which is precisely what I see you all doing. So let me ask you this. If people are interested in kind of like kind of helping support your work, about finding out more about what you're doing in Grant Township or what your organization is doing kind of writ larger, where can they go and what can they do?
Yeah, several places. One is CELDEF's website, celdf.org. I don't know if there's a place where people can go for that. Also, the Pennsylvania Community Rights Network is a coalition of groups from across the state that are beginning to work on the state level stuff. We have been for a few years. And also with Grant Township, they have a Facebook page, and also they have a local group called the East Run Hellbenders Society. You can get in touch with them there as well. And if any, you know, I don't know if you can put my contact information up. Also, it's available on CELDEF's website, but anybody can get in touch with me, and we have a lot of different places where they can plug in. We can also put you on email lists and things like that.
Fantastic. We will definitely put all those links in the show notes for today. And if you kind of missed anything today, you kind of came in late, and if there's the information is, you can't find the link that you want more information, you let me know and I'll track it down for it. I'll make sure that you get it. Well, listen, Chad, I really appreciate you taking the time out tonight. Like I said, I'm floored by the work that you're doing. Good luck on kind of moving forward with Grant Township and other township across Pennsylvania and beyond this. But thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate you having us on. And anytime there's other questions or want to have more discussion, let me know.
You got it. All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. And thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. Before you go, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel. Make sure you smash that like button. Pass the word. Appreciate all the comments, all the questions. On Monday, next week, we are going to have some more stuff on fracking. We'll talk to you then. This is Kevin Mahoney. I'm out of here. See ya.